Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlossophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlossophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always...
Silencio, Bruno! I don't introduce myself this time.
Oh my god.
It is I, Spencer Williams, your other host.
Oh, okay, that was unplanned, but cool. We got a great show in stores. We're going to be talking about the recently dropped Disney Pixar film Luca. And of course, we could not do this review without our resident
Julia
lifeguard, if you will, lifeguard expert, because you used to be a lifeguard.
I'm still Julia at this point.
Okay, you're our resident
Julia,
resident real life Julia. Intern Amy / part-timer.
I'm part-time. I got an intern sticker now again. Last week I was all part-time dance and part-time that. Well, okay.
I mean, we still got to do the 90-day review, so, you know.
We haven't even had 90 days!
We got a great show in stores. We're going to be talking about the movie and giving our thoughts on the film. But before we do, Spencer, why don't you give them opening credits?
Tune in each and every Wednesday morning on all your favorite streaming platforms and over on our website at filmlossophers.com. Also, connect with us on the socials at facebook.com/filmlossophers and on Twitter and Instagram at filmlossophy101.
Our website is growing. We have a much larger number than I had originally thought when I went to the website because I forgot where we were at in terms of numbers.
And this numbers is what?
Episodes.
He doesn't remember.
Do
how
you
many
not
are
recall
catalog.
We record episodes?
Yeah. Well, I don't know what kind of number, like, you know, hits on the web page, all that
oh,
kind
I don't
of
know
thing.
About any of that. I yeah. leave that to the webmaster.
Oh, my God.
Aren't you the webmaster?
Nope.
He's the page master.
So, oh, my God.
Check it out, filmlossophers.com. We got over 270 episodes over there. Check us out. Let us know what you think. Find us on any streaming platform. You know all the places. iTunes, Google Play, Libsyn, Player FM, Pandora, Spotify, all them loveliness. Drop us a line. Let us know what you think of the podcast. Give us a 5-star review. We'd love to hear from you. As well, check out all of our social pages. This is a very interesting film to kind of begin the summer, I guess, if you will, because the film is essentially, it almost feels like perpetual summer, but the unique thing about this movie is that it was one of the, it's probably going to be the last one they do on demand.
They better.
Which,
I talk about that later.
which we have, you know, thoughts about, but yeah, we are talking about Disney Pixar's Luca. This film was released on demand without the, what was it, the premiere access,
which
you
is usually $30.
Easily.
Yes. This one wasn't one of those types of films, thankfully, and so we all got a chance to check it out and see it, and of course, needless to say, we all have our unique opinions about the film. There's going to be a lot of conversations and whatnot. Spencer actually wished there was more, you know, other things in the movie. I don't know.
He doesn't know. It's like, what are you talking about?
So, without further ado, why don't, Spencer, before we go any further, you give us that official synopsis goodness.
Set in a beautiful seaside town on the Italian Riviera, the original animated feature is a coming-of-age story about one young boy experiencing an unforgettable summer filled with gelato, pasta, and endless scooter rides. Luca shares these adventures with his newfound best friends, but all the fun is threatened by a deeply held secret. He's a sea monster from another world just below the surface.
Yes. I was caught up in what you were talking about. I'm like looking at the audio moving. I'm like, yeah, that's pretty good. Oh, wait, we're doing a podcast. Directed by Enrico Casarosa. In his actual feature-length directorial debut, the film stars the voices of Jacob Tremblay, Jack Dylan Grazer, Emma Berman, Saverio Raimondo, Maya Rudolph, Marco Baricelli, Jim Gaffigan, Peter Son, Lorenzo Crisci? Not sure. Marina Massironi and Sandy Martin.
With a cameo appearance by Sacha Baron Cohen.
Which we don't speak of.
Too late, I just eat.
So, As I mentioned, this was director Enrico Casarosa's feature-length directorial debut. However, the director is also known for another work that he did with Disney Pixar, and that is Luna.
I thought it was La Luna.
La Luna? Is it La Luna or Luna?
I thought it was La Luna.
Well,
it's the charming short that has a grandfather, a father, or three generations of Italian men going out to help change the waxing and the waning of the moon. It's very sweet.
Yeah. And oddly enough, you see a lot of his art style that was derived from that in Luca, which is great. One of the things that actually that is unique about the film is that the director actually drew a lot of his inspiration from the films of Hayao Miyazaki.
Yeah.
If you don't know who Hayao Miyazaki is, how dare you?
There has been an anime month, and Miyazaki was spoken of.
It was mostly.
I think it was all.
Not this last one.
No, not this last one, but the one before. And mind you, you can see it in just about a lot of the things that he creates in this film. The character Luca's original last name was Porto Rosso, a nod to Miyazaki's 1992 film Porco Rosso. In the final version of the film, though, the character surname was changed and the name of the town was changed to Porto Rosso. Unfortunately, there is some negative attention that's being regarded with this film in, like we mentioned, in its release. Many Pixar employees are actually upset at the move to make the film a Disney Plus exclusive, actually putting out statements that doing it with 2020 Soul in the middle of the COVID-19 pandemic was understandable, but doing it twice in a row with the vaccine rollout ramping up and not even putting it behind a premium paywall like Raya and the Last Dragon or the god-awful Cruella.
Or Mulan.
Really don't understand what they're doing with premium access.
I have no idea.
Because, like, you should have done it on the Pixar movies and not the other ones.
They would have made so much money on all the Pixar movies.
Oh, yeah.
Immediately. Everyone would have done it.
I would have been hella bad, but I would have done it.
Not putting it behind that premium paywall, it actually began to give the impression that the studio, Pixar itself, isn't respected by Disney executives. Which speaks a lot if you really think about it. Like, the fact that you have Pixar employees, people who toil in and out, people who have been toiling on these films, not like in a negative connotation, but they work hard ever since Toy Story, putting out a great product every time. I mean, let's be honest, until Disney kind of took over, and or not took over, but assimilated with Pixar, Disney's movies didn't hit that way. Like, Pixar just hit different every time. Mm-hmm. You watch a Pixar film and you walk away like psychoanalyzed and like, oh my gosh, I need to talk to my grandma more. Or like things like, oh my gosh, how many people do I have talking in my head? You know,
or like in the first 5 minutes of Up, you have like,
oh my
this
gosh.
Whole crisis.
Oh my gosh. Up will give you a darn near anxiety attack because you're like, oh my God. Like,
there is nothing that Disney has done proper that's even close to that.
No. And oddly enough, kind of on a little bit of a rabbit trail, oddly enough, that opening has probably got to be one of the best film openings of all time. One of. I'm not saying it's not the. I'm pretty sure there's some, you know, film scholar out there that's like, well, what you don't understand, pushing up their glasses, and, you know, what you don't understand is the 1932 film by Fritz Freleng, which is blah, blah. No. This movie, Up, is a unique film in that it hits you right at the beginning. Even when you're not expecting, when you literally are just going down to sit with your popcorn, you're like, oh no, da 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 da, checking to make sure your phone's turned off. You're over here munching on a sour punch straw or something, and then you turn and look, and boom, right in the feels.
Yeah, no dialogue, really great music, amazingly.
Well, and amazingly, like, orchestrated in terms of how the scenes work.
Mm-hmm.
It was phenomenal. But talking about Luca, sorry. So to hear that, that's something that Pixar, because I have friends who work at Pixar. And I've seen, I'm not going to name them because that's not why I'm friends with them, you know, but I've seen them post things like in support of and things like that. And it's like, how do you forget? Like, how do you, as a large company like the House of Mouse, how do you forget all those people who are working hard to make sure that their product gets the attention it wants? I mean, they went through a whole thing at Disneyland with the Avengers Campus. Like, they, and they put all that money behind that.
Well, how about we establish that when Pixar came to play, Disney Animation took a hard toilet bowl spin and was not able to recover, not only in storytelling, but in design. Oh,
yeah.
And even after poaching one John Lasseter to head up Disney Animation, which did, for a bit, a good turn, and looking at the startup, you know, Steve Jobs was one of their main investors from the start. Pixar is a threat. And Pixar, even under the banner of the House of Mouse, it's okay, you're part of the family, but no, really.
Yeah. And it's easy to, like, as fans of the movies and the films for as long as we've been fans, it's easy to distinguish where the lines, like, where Disney went up to and then Pixar's like, hey there, kiddo, I'll take it from here. And all those films where you see, like, that extra, that little bit of, like take, for instance, Soul. Soul was... You thought at first, like, okay, how are they going to discuss the meaning of life and death in a children's film? And how are they going to actually create a film around that? And we actually talked about it on the episode, on the podcast. We did a review of Soul. And honestly, it still is like, I would have never have gone that route that they did with Soul. It makes, to a child, it makes, and I mentioned this in the episode, it makes that kind of conversation with a child so much easier because you're like, oh, well, when a child asks, is there a heaven or is there a hell? Or you know, what happens when you die? Like, because we get, you know, if you've been around kids a lot, where I was a preschool teacher for 10 years, when you're around kids a lot like that, you get those kinds of questions. You get people, you get little kids coming up and asking you the most randomest but, like, soul-searching, gut-wrenching questions that you're like, I don't get paid enough to answer this. But it's like, you know, you want to give them something that not only will satisfy their current curiosity, but it's something they'll hold on to for the rest of their life. And I think that's what Pixar does. Pixar is like imagination in view. Like, you see somebody who wants to create a movie about the different moods in people, and they end up creating actual personifications of those moods, and then they create the whole idea of, well, you have the sour with the sweet, you have the good with the bad, and they sell it home. And it's like, yeah, like, the, and I call them geniuses because they are, like, I don't know how the geniuses get to that point to where they take that simple idea and then they turn it into gold and serve it up, and it makes it. And I always go back when it comes to Pixar, because I love Pixar. I love a lot of their products. I love just about everything that they've done, minus one, probably, The Good Dinosaur.
Which you've never seen, and it's okay.
I don't plan to, really. throw me under the bus again. That's hey. Two buses in 2 weeks.
It's a bus a week. They come by. We know the schedule.
Apparently.
I think the biggest thing in loving the content that comes from the studio and the creators at Pixar is, literally, you hit it, it's a simple concept. It is, the story comes from these simple concepts. There was somewhere that, and I think it was before or right after WALL-E came out, where they actually had a conversation and somebody had interviewed the director, I think it was for WALL-E, and had asked, hey, so where did this come from? And he talked about that John Lasseter, Brad Bird, and him had sat down and on napkins they had written out their plan for all the different movies they wanted to make in however long the span is. And I remember hearing this interview, and then WALL-E was one of them, and that it was they wanted to address and have a conversation about consumerism and about caring for the planet, and that's what they came up with. And I was like, holy smokes, that's so good. And we're not even talking about the opportunities that they give to everyone that does the shorts, because the shorts are also in such spaces that there's so much care in taking to create them. The most recent one, of course, is Burrow with the Bunny Rabbit that came out before Soul. Yes, that was actually theirs. But my favorite is still going to be Piper, which there is no words. It's all musical, but it's literally about a little baby Piper bird. And I gets all the feels, but we're supposed to be talking about Luca. Well,
because you went on some tangent in that direction. But what I was trying to say is that when I see a Pixar film, one of the biggest things, me as a film critic and a former educator, one of the things I see is, how will this enrich a child's life? What will a child take away from it? And how will that translate to a parent or to an adult in terms of bridging that conversation? you look at how Pixar works, and I know we're on this rabbit trail. I promise you we're going to get back to Luca. But if you look at the way Pixar works, I had a great opportunity to go to Pixar a couple years ago before the pandemic and talk to some of the guys and the creatives. And I remember one of them had brought up that because somebody had mentioned, it might have been the same interview, someone had mentioned the Pixar story narrative formula, the storytelling formula. And they had mentioned, they said every single person who comes to Pixar or is in Pixar and has an idea has to follow these 8 simple steps. He said, it's number 1, once upon a time there was blank. Step 2, every day blank. Number 3, one day blank. Then number 4, because of that blank. 5 and 6, because of that blank and because of that blank. Number 7, until finally blank. And then number 8, ever since then blank. And you look at every film that Pixar has done, and they use that formula for every film, and it makes sense because it's like you're building a story, but you're not just building a story; you're building a reason for the story, and you're building the story beneath the story. You know, the whole because of that, and because of that, and because of that, you're expounding on the hero's journey, so to speak. And so I say all that to say, with people who have been doing the due diligence in not only changing the landscape for children's films since 1995, you would think that at this point they would definitely already have that respect. So to kind of see where some people are stepping out and like saying, hey, you know, we are doing the best we can. We are actually innovators in this age of movies when it comes to children's movies that, you know, without us, to be quite frank, I don't think Disney would have made it as far as they have. I honestly think Disney is literally standing on the shoulders of what Pixar had started doing. So, but I step down from my soapbox as we jump back over to the more lighter conversation of Luca. Spencer's looking like he's ready to just move. He's like, I'm done with this. Just
I'm trying not to say a whole bunch of stuff about Disney. That's what I'm trying
to say. It.
No, it's just like,
I want to know, because like, I have a chip on my shoulder for Disney. I don't, I'm going to be honest, I'm not a big fan of the powerhouse that Disney has become.
The powerhouse that they mostly bought.
I don't think, yes, exactly. That actually is more correct than calling Disney out and out a powerhouse. There was a time where they were creating content that mm-hmm. was ahead of its time. They stumbled, they fumbled, they had a renaissance.
And then they bought people.
And then they started going, do you know what? Why should we invest in-house when we can absorb from outside?
Why reinvent the wheel when you can steal it off of somebody else's
car?
Exactly.
Why have competition when they can just be us?
Exactly. Which is exactly what you're looking
one
at.
Of us. One of us.
But that's also, in a way, and it's true, they literally have absorbed and taken everyone, and now it's like, oh, yes, Disney, but they're functioning under Disney/Pixar. No, it should still be Pixar Studios.
Yeah.
And they should give them the respect that that team has earned.
Well, and much like the state of Texas in our current social political environment, I have no doubt that maybe Pixar might get wise and, like, you know, what is it, succeed from the...
Is that even possible?
I don't think they can succeed.
You know what? You don't know. I mean, look what... You have all these different entities that are that
and
make up Disney.
And you don't think Disney's going to blackball anybody that walks up?
Who is going to blackball Pixar? Let me ask
Disney.
You this.
Disney.
They'll blackball them, of course.
There was the song of Don Bluth.
No. Okay, Don Bluth is a whole different story. Okay, Don
Tim
Bluth.
Burton. And keep going.
This is why we keep you as an intern, because you keep trying to do this. Listen.
He's trying to demote you.
Oh my gosh. What I'm saying is this. You have people who have stepped out from underneath that banner. And yes, they may have had their notoriety. Maybe some didn't shine as bright as they had hoped, i.e. Don Bluth. But people like Tim Burton, still doing all of his great work. And that, mind you, that's just creators. We're not talking about the conglomerate that is Pixar. We're not talking about the entire company that is Pixar in themselves. Emeryville is just down the road from where we are. Literally, it's just a straight shot from here down the freeway, and we can hit Pixar Studios. You know how long it's going to take us to get to Walt Disney Studios from here?
They're in Burbank, and there's a lot of traffic, so yes.
Okay, so what I'm saying is there's space and there's opportunity. And I'm not saying, you know, oh, rebel and everybody at Pixar tomorrow, you know, bring your pitchforks and whatever. No, I'm not saying that. But what I'm saying is that there has to be a sense of respect, because if you don't, and it's kind of the whole overarching theme in anything, whether it's business, relationships, video games or whatever. If you don't respect the relationships that you have, someone else will step in and respect it. Like, someone else will take over that. And mind you with this, if it's not Pixar, I mean, I know Disney is probably one of the biggest, and I'm saying one of, because there are others. I mean, Turner Classic, what's his name?
Warren Buffett?
Is it Warren Buffett who owns
he owns a lot of stuff.
He owns things.
There's other entities, there's other enterprises that are on equal par of where Disney is in terms of, you know, size and power. And what would it take for someone to say, you know what? One of those ones to say, you know what? I want to start a Disney. And one of them just snatch Pixar out of there and immediately give them a different platform.
I'm fairly certain you can't snatch Disney Pixar out.
Well, they would have to buy it, obviously.
No,
but
I don't think that's... Yeah, Spencer's actually correct. That's a lot of legalese that none of us have access to because of NDAs. So talking about that is kind of like... It's taking
NDAs.
Yes, it's taking Fritos from the Frito-Lay brand. You ain't gonna get it. You might have the recipe, but you ain't gonna get it.
That would be one thing to say, but the entire company is Fritos. So you can't say the one product that's named after the one thing. It's like saying, you know, oh, we're going to take the image of Walt Disney from Disneyland.
Why do you think they attached Disney to Disney Pixar and didn't just say it's Pixar like they did with Miramax, where they were releasing, what, all their shenanigan titles underneath that? But they didn't want it to be associated with Disney? Do we recall that? I'm here to talk about Luca.
She's demoted. So obviously
a whole
this is
half a week.
This conversation is, mind you, there is legalese, whatever, however you want to see it. However, though, there are real people who are hurting. As oblivious as you may be, Amy, there are real people hurting,
so
and there are real people who are trying to figure out how to make sure that they continue to get that recognition. Here's the thing: if Pixar were to diminish themselves to nobody, then guess what? There's no Pixar, because if everybody chooses to leave because they're not getting the respect to go somewhere else, guess what? The people who know those movies and love them, they'll go with them. Don Bluth only had a very small window because we were really young and parents weren't really all that for whatever we were watching then. Tim Burton has evolved and grown. We're looking at people who are willing to do whatever it takes so that the way they get the recognition they deserve. Just because their work is tied to a company that won't look at them, you know, every other 5 seconds because they're not doing anything they like, doesn't mean that they don't deserve that recognition. And so if they need to, they could up and go. And then where's Pixar then? Where's your beloved Piper? Where's all that? It's in the past because it won't be in the future anytime soon. So, going back to Luca, since you wanted to go ahead and throw your... Because it was like I was just hypothesizing.
You weren't hypothesizing.
And you ran the third bus on me. So, it's fine.
It's on a timetable.
So, talking about Luca...
It happens on Tuesdays.
Talking about Luca, one of the biggest things that we can say about Luca is that it had been talked about and had been hyped for a while. There was actually supposed to be a film before Luca that was supposed to come out, but it didn't. It was about giants. I forget.
Didn't that one get like canceled or something?
It did. It got fully canceled. There's another one about lizards that was supposed to come out, or it's still on
hold.
The
one about geckos was still on hold. The one about the giants, which was slightly alluded to in Onward, which was the Jack and when they drive the Guinevere the Pegasus through all of the beanstalks, all the giant beanstalks. That was supposed to be a reference to the next one, which was supposed to be a version of Jack and the
Beanstalk. Just called Giants.
Yeah. Hmm. There you go.
So there was things prior to, but there had been ideas that they were going to, after doing Coco, realizing that there's a huge market for the traditional culture of places. When it came to doing things like Coco, people really, really, you know, responded to it really well. So the next step for them was to try another culture, another, you know, place where society is different other than what we're used to seeing. And they went with Italy, and i.e. we got Luca. So after you guys saw the trailer, what were some of your expectations? I want to start with Amy.
Why me?
Because I know you have a lot to say maybe about the expectations. I don't know. It's on a timetable. Who knows? So.
Oh, wow. Ha, cha, cha. I'm just the intern, so what do I know? So expectations initially, there was a lot of just trailer or like teaser trailers. Mm-hmm. So there was essentially much like the fabled sea monster that Luca is. It was the passing of a fin. It was the water. You know, it was nothing that you could really kind of grasp. And then after seeing the first trailer, I was kind of gobsmacked in a good way, because it was so unexpected and it was so bright and beautiful. And it was, I'm not going to say an abrupt turn, but it was such a turn for me to see something that carried so much light in its color scheme.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about the palette itself.
Yeah, the palette itself. And I was excited because I'm like, I don't know what this journey is going to look like. And coming off of Soul, which those tones were, there was warmth in those tones. There was never anything just bright, like outward bright. Like
it had a darker tone to it in terms of color palette.
Yeah.
Darker blues, darker midnight colors, things like that.
Well, and then like even with New York, when you see like the trees, the leaves, the stoops, the store, everything had a different feel and texture to the color. Versus Luca, which was really, really bright. So I didn't really know what to expect. I was very excited to kind of see what was going to come of it. And I was just along for the ride. Spencer, help. I'm just the intern now.
Oh my gosh.
So sad when people get demoted for no good reason. It's a crime.
Yeah, it is.
So my expectations. Well, first, like, with the teaser trailers, I was like, okay, so, like, Summertime looks fun. Like, I'm down for it. They were like barely anything. And then when, like, you know, the actual trailer came out, I was like, cool, this seems like, you know, fun sea monsters who are just here for like the summer to do whatever. Like, that sounds like it's gonna be a fun time for everybody. So that was kind of it. I was just on board for this movie like the second like I found out
about
it.
So as soon as you saw the trailer, you're like, count me in.
Yeah, like, and really honestly, any Pixar movies really count me in.
You know, that
really
is the honest
many
truth.
Where I've been like, nah.
Very true.
Like Cars and the Good Dinosaur. I just didn't see it.
The Planes one.
Oh, I forgot that existed.
See, like regular Cars, even Cars 1, 2, 3, whatever.
No. 2 was horrible.
I will say
2 was bad.
That Cars 3 trailer did like make me look.
Oh,
at
Oh man,
second.
That first Cars that, trailer.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That was an
the
amazing
one where
trailer.
They didn't even include that, like that specific scene in the movie. They totally redid it, but they did all that work for just that one teaser trailer of that car of lightning flipping over.
And yeah,
over
all of us were just like, what?
Yeah, you're just like, they're gonna kill lightning.
That was like, that was the Captain America. That was the last panel, last page of Secret Empire with Captain America saying "Hail Hydra."
Oh my gosh.
That was that moment encapsulated in something where we were like, "Oh yeah, it's Lightning McQueen." What?
Because you're like, "Oh my gosh, this looks so real. Look, it looks like NASCAR." Oh yeah, what's the sparks in the bottom of the screen? Oh, somebody's flipping. Oh no! And then it just fades to black, and you're like, "No."
people know how to sell stuff.
Well, I mean, they know how to cut a trailer is
that
what
trailer
they know how to
cutting,
do.
Though, right there.
I think one of the biggest things for me was I was wondering, in terms of expectations, I think for me, I was wondering whether or not this film was going to meet those traditional standards of the people they were going to emulate. It's one thing to do Coco and really hit it out of the park, but let's be honest, Coco is lightning in a bottle. Like, the whole idea of what Coco the movie is about is wonderful. Going back to Pixar's ability to create engaging characters and wonderful backstories, and against popular, you know, having an unpopular opinion, I actually really like the villain twists in a lot of the Pixar films. There is this whole like kind of up and coming conversation about how all Pixar has are villain twists, and the villain isn't exactly who you think it is. It's actually somebody else. And then sure enough, it they like with Coco and you know what I'm saying. Like, the twist on the villain, you know, especially with Frozen, where it's...
Frozen was in Pixar.
I don't know. I'm just telling
Thank
you what I've read.
Thank the Lord.
Yeah.
Sorry. Toy Story 3.
Yeah, that was one.
Up. Carl
Toy Munch. Story...
3. Yeah, 3, because that was Sunnyside.
Technically, Toy Story 4, which didn't really end up having a villain. Mm-hmm. But like what I'm saying, there's a lot of aspects where the films have that kind of twist on the villain, or there's some type of unique twist. And mind you, I actually like that. I really do. I like the way that that flows and the unique kind of surprise at that point in the film. But what I was hoping for was I was hoping to see Pixar, like, you know, get that hole in the one two times in a row. Like, I really wanted them to make sure that they didn't just kind of skirt on. Not that I know they do that, because I don't know if I've ever seen them do it, but when you emulate a tradition or a group of people, or, you know, a heritage, you have to get it on the money. Like, I kid you not, if they had not gotten Coco correctly, a mob of Latinos would have stormed the buildings and the gates over at Disney Studios and would have told them what for. Like, to say, you know what, you didn't capture us at all correctly. You don't even know a thing about us. And thankfully they did. They did their homework and so forth. And I didn't find out. Like, normally with Coco, you saw, oh, they actually went to Mexico, they did X, Y, and Z, blah, 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 blah. And you're like, okay. I didn't know, I hadn't heard of anything of them going to wherever to get inspiration. I wasn't aware that they had sent a team, and it just kind of made me have that, like, question at the front of my mind. Are they going to make sure that they honor the people they're going to emulate?
Quick question. Did they tell people that before the movie's release? Because I never find out until after.
No, they did it
for Coco before the film debuted.
Oh.
Well, so for the most part, in keeping with the tradition that actually Walt Disney started, they took a page out of Walt's book where he would bring, for like Bambi, he brought in live animals into the studio for the animators to engage with so that they could learn to better draw characters. It continued with into the Renaissance, where for Lion King they brought different animals and you could see it on the featurettes. But Pixar particularly, and I can think of in Up, they went to Peru. They usually say afterwards where they've gone to find inspiration or where they're drawing from, especially given by their the director of photography and then their director outright. They bring other people after that with them, but they do scouting to go, we want to tell a story about this one. It's Italy. And the director goes, I know exactly where we want to go. Let's go here. And he took a team of four or five people.
He technically took them to his hometown. That's where he took them to.
Among other villages as well.
Yeah, they went to multiple places. Mm-hmm. I remember that.
Yeah, but so it's kind of a tradition that Walt started, but Pixar just seems to collectively, consistently knock it out of the park.
In terms of first impressions after the film debuted, after you saw the film, I want to start with Spence, since Amy had a little bit of an offense because I picked her first. Spence, what were your first impressions as soon as you saw the film?
This was a beautiful movie. Mm-hmm. Like, it was one of those movies where you just kind of, like, are left speechless at the end of it. Just... the overall story was fantastic, and I loved the sound of just the music in this movie. It was really well done and just had, like, a very light summer vibe, like, through the whole thing.
Yeah.
So, I was just blown away, really.
What about you, Amy?
I think Stunned Silence is very, very good. Like, there was an overwhelming collection of emotions going on. It's absolutely stunning, and it kind of did what a good movie always did for me, which is, okay, I need to watch it again. Like,
the rewatchability factor of
it. And it wasn't because of, like, oh, there's something I missed. It was, oh, I want to enjoy this again.
You want to experience it again. You want
to savor it.
Yeah, I have to agree. After I saw it the first time, because there have been multiple viewings, I was in a place where it was like I didn't know whether I wanted to cry or just applaud. mind you, sitting there watching the movie, it's like this movie is so many different things for different people, and anybody can grab whatever they need from it to make it their own story. And I was like, this is the epitome of what Pixar does. And I was, as weird as it sounds, I was proud for a minute of being a fan of Pixar, because you're like, oh my God, these are the people I root for, and these people that I root for knock it out of the park every time. Maybe not every time, but the majority of the time. And it's something that I cling to as part of the storytelling of me still growing up, me still becoming me. You know, we all have those moments where we hear our parents talk about, oh, you know, I used to have this storybook and it had this, or I used to have these collections and I had these stories and those stories and these stories. Like, literally, these movies are the stories to our lives. Like, these are the storybook stories to our lives. We look back and we think of the most fondest stories that we've ever heard or things like that as kids. And we think about Toy Story. We think about Toy Story 2, 3.
Toy Story.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of different things, you know, that create that feeling. And watching this, and like you said, Spencer, at the end of that movie, literally, as that music is swelling and it's just like so... I've been thinking for the last 2 weeks of how best to describe the soundtrack. And I came to the idea that the music is like, it's modernized yet romanticized Italian, like, day music, like the music that you would hear probably in the streets or things like that. But it's in a more sense, like, there's a little bit more of a modern aspect to it, but it's romanticized as well. It's elongated with large string sounds, and it's built with swells, and there's slight drums here, but then there's a build here of like this harmony of voices and a cacophony of different synths, and there's different things in it that make it so beautiful. And like, this movie has probably got to be one of my new mini favorites of Pixar, because I was blown away. And one of the first things, kind of jumping right in, that I was blown away by, I got to give credit where credit is due. Jacob Tremblay has come up in the world. Like, to be quite frank, I remember him from, like I said, from Room with Brie Larson, and even then, he was a phenomenal actor. That little boy was solid. The scenes that he had to do in that movie, the emotionality behind it, he hit it on the money. A lot of his work that I've seen since then, like The Book of Henry, he had a small role in Doctor Sleep. He was in Wonder. He was in the what was that movie that we were talking about? Good Boys. I didn't see it, but Jacob Tremblay has gone up to become a very formidable actor against all other kid actors. Like, even some of the classic ones from like the 80s and whatnot, like, I would, if I were to put out like a whole span of all these kids that have been actors from when they were really small to like 5 or 6 all the way up until they're like in their mid to late teens, Jacob Tremblay has got to be up there as like one of the strongest and most consistent actors. I don't know, what do you guys think?
No, I can agree on that. Considering that I only know him from I had read the book for Room and did not want to see it, regardless of how amazing everyone has said it is. It's just,
it is.
Well, it's a really heavy story.
I know.
So I didn't get to see him in that. And the first time that I do recall actually seeing him on screen was traumatizing. Kudos to you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, because I saw him in Dr. Sleep, yep. And he ends up being the Little Leaguer.
Yep.
If you haven't seen Dr. Sleep.
You've seen Dr. Sleep, right?
We talked about it on the podcast.
Well, I also asked you if you saw The Book of Henry, and you said you hadn't seen it, and I could have swore we talked about it on the podcast.
Nope.
Okay, well, so he's the little boy who gets... You remember him in the movie, right?
He gets tortured.
Remember the little boy they take to the like, abandoned factory or whatever?
And they torture him.
And they bury him there.
Oh, that kid!
That's Jacob Tremblay.
Yeah, so that's the first time I saw him, which I was left in literal screaming, crying tears, because I was like, this child. And then,
but he nails it. I mean,
he nailed it. But and then in this, he captured so many emotions so quickly, and such an innocence in who he was. But he embodied that those first steps of finding your best friend. And then with I cannot remember the other guy, and I'm going to mispronounce his name.
Are you talking about Jack Dylan Grazer?
Yes. Unsurprising to everybody, I have not seen it, the new chapter. So as much as I've been able to see him was Shazam.
Which he was good in Shazam.
He was great.
If it was his springboard, then Shazam was his really kind of stretching a lot of his efforts.
Well, and even in that, he's comedic. He's well timed. It's well written, but he acts it in such a way that it makes it fun. And in this, I mean, we've got such amazing, memorable characters. And then the girl who plays Julia, she was absolutely breathtaking as Emma
Berman, I think.
And she's adorable. I saw one of the featurettes and I was like, this girl is adorable.
Yeah, I actually thought she was a little older than she actually is, but once you see her in the videos that are on like online on YouTube, whatever, she's not that old. She's a young girl, but mm-hmm. she's got like kind of that rasp that makes her sound older, and it's like, oh, cool.
Well, and it was really nice to see, even watching the featurettes, she's not vocally stretching very far out from where she is naturally, and she's got such a great tilt in her voice of just enthusiasm, which is something that's so great to experience from different voice actors, and to see how she melds and she helps to be the extra corner of this crazy Italian triangle for the summer. Like, it's so well done and it's so well acted, and even with the little bits we get with Jim Gaffigan being really weird as the dad. And then Maya Rudolph, hello again, Maya Rudolph. Like, it seems to be a feature of this. So,
what about you, Spence? Who are some of the standout voice actors that maybe Amy listed and didn't list in the long list of everybody?
I'm going to go again with Jacob Tremblay. Like, that kid was amazing.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize he was the kid from Dr. Sleep, so that's awesome.
There you go. You learned that you could actually see him die in a movie. That's...
but really, most of the voice actors in this movie are really great because, like, they really sell their parts. Even the people who are in there for really weird uncle parts.
Oh my gosh!
Just like, what is happening?
Who is that person?
Sacha Baron Cohen comes in and he's like an uncle from the deep sea who is terrified.
He is like there's. There's a scene where they look up, where someone looks up at a poster on the wall and they're like, Udo or whatever his name was, mm-hmm. thinking it's him, and it's like the creature from the Black Lagoon. It's a horror movie poster. But yeah, that was really unsettling. Like, he made that character really unsettling. I think also the fact that Luca had to punch him in the heart to get him going was very interesting. but yeah, like his whole spiel. I don't even want to call it a monologue, because it wasn't a monologue.
No, he had an end of movie monologue, though.
He did.
By himself in the deep. Yeah, the whole character. Bizarre. Don't know why he was in here, but kind of liked it.
Uncle Ugo.
Ugo, Udo, all of them, Udo.
It was scary, though.
That was really trippy. So, but yeah, everybody in this film really does kind of excel in creating just a very familial vibe. It never seems like it's like a forced thing. Maya Rudolph has become synonymous with playing moms, because this is the second time we see her play a mom, a third time.
Well, we saw her with Linda in The Willoughbys. She was mom-esque. Oh,
okay. Yeah,
she was Linda in there. She was Linda in Mitchell's, and now she's a Daniela.
Which Linda in Mitchell's is the mom.
Yeah.
And then she plays the mom here to Luca. There's a lot of great things. Unfortunately, I don't know how much of the character Ercole, the guy who plays him, I've never heard of him. So if anybody has ever heard of his work or know where he's from, I'd love to know where he comes from, because he played a very good like villain, but he also played a little bit of the on-the-nose Italian villain, I guess. I don't know. How did you guys feel about that? Kind of with the main villain kind of embodying the typical Italian stereotype. Like, he was followed around everywhere with those big sandwiches. He rode a Vespa. He had, like, the sweater around his neck, all the time. It was almost like the frat boy version of Italians, which I don't know. I don't know if that's how they normally dress. I'm not. I don't know. But I'm saying, how did you guys feel about his personification or his character?
I didn't understand why he had a big sandwich everywhere.
Neither did I. I've never saw him eat it. Like, I was like wondering, what the heck is he doing with this big sandwich? And he had one everywhere.
Yeah, it was odd. He was an odd character.
That's a very nice way to put it.
Yeah.
Because also at the same time, Ercole is also apparently older than the majority of the kids
he's
there.
He's older than 16.
Yeah. We know he's older than 16. He's won the race at least 6 times, working on his 7th time. And in the event of everything, he at least is hitting somewhere in his like early 20s, maybe 20. Like, because if he's won 6 times...
I think he's been lying for that long.
I don't know. I mean, or maybe at least, I mean, he's at least 18. We know that much.
Yeah, we can easily say that.
I mean, because if you have to be able to swim faster than everyone else, eat as much pasta, and then ride the bike, you have to be, like, physically capable.
So you're between 10 and up.
Give or take, maybe. Yeah. So if you take, I don't know. It's very interesting. But his character is just really, really... I think the age thing really kind of threw me. Like, if they hadn't did the whole age thing, maybe I would be okay with that. But, like, there's so much emphasis on, like, aren't you a little old? How old are you? Aren't you... You people know... Blah, blah, blah. Like, okay, we get it. He's older. We get it. I have to admit, the unsung hero for me was one of his henchmen who at the end helps him, like, give him what he deserves. Chicho.
Do you know who plays him, by the way?
No, I don't.
Pete, I think his name, well, his first name's Peter, but Peter San. He is Emil from Ratatouille, and he is Squishy from Monsters University. I am not even lying.
Oh, he is. Oh, he's also, no, he's not.
But he is, yeah, he gives him the what for, but also he gets doused in that olive oil and all of those little anchovies are biting him. And he's just in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, no, little man, come back. Come back to us.
That's actually a really cool thing. I didn't know that. I knew who it was, but I didn't know he actually had other voice roles. Mm-hmm. But yeah, his whole, like, putting his hand into his fist after he realizes he's done, he's like, like, that was great. Were there any other standout performers for you guys? Like, I don't know the actor's name who played Massimo, the father, but I really liked the way he presented and the way the character was done. Mm-hmm. Was there anybody else stand out for you guys?
Definitely Massimo. And the cat.
That cat.
Machiavelli. Oh, yeah. Between Massimo and Machiavelli, on the initial trailer, just seeing them together, I was like, is the man a cat or is the cat a man? Like, because of the way this cat is designed with that proper mustache, he looks like he's, like, part Massimo. Like, they're a tag team. And then the interaction on screen... both from each of them separate, like, independently, is so wonderful. Like, it's just, it's good.
Yeah.
I never thought, like, I thought, you know, watching the trailer, that this cat was just going to be, like, you know, in the background. It's like, I know something's up, blah, 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 and I'm stalking you type thing.
Yeah.
I did not expect the cat to just come after Alberto like that.
Yeah, in the very beginning when he attacks Luca and Alberto in that very beginning, like... No, Machiavelli, no. And then he just leaps and it's like total mayhem. The whole idea that they have to keep him at bay with, like, fish, it's great. But kind of transitioning from the character design to just the ultimate overall art style, one of the things that you have to appreciate about the film is how much they wanted to create that sense of authenticity without taking away from that childlike, I guess, familiarity with it as well that you get with Pixar. Like the rounded edges, the big size heads with the bodies and just the funny way they create characters. One of the things I don't know if you guys knew was that Pixar actually intentionally created Luca to have much larger eyes than everybody else in the film. It was to kind of signify his awe and wonder of the world around him and kind of being exposed to all those things, which made for great scenes when Luca would come upon something, like when the first time he sees the Vespa, and you actually see his eyes dilate as they get larger as he's staring at it, or you see him when he's looking at like the sky, or when he's, you know, looking at the human town or whatever. But one of the things that I wanted to ask you guys, because I want your guys' opinion, where did you see some of the biggest inspirational parts of the film from Miyazaki in this movie? Because I know I saw a few, but I know I wanted to see which ones you guys got. Maybe you guys got something different. Amy, let's go and start with you, because it looks like you're about to gush.
I won't take the easy one if you want to take it.
See, I'm having a hard time remembering, because I remember watching and I was like, looked at something and I was like, oh, that's just like Miyazaki, but now you don't remember what it was.
So I've got a couple. So the first,
so don't do the easy one then.
Okay.
Because maybe it'll come back to him.
The Wind Rises. Think about that.
I estate.
No, because that's the direct lead-in. So if you, but for me, the sequences of Alberto and Luca running down the hill with the grass, the scope and the scape of that had some particular Miyazaki moments, as well as the beaches, and then the people within the town itself, and getting like that initial piazza shot was very reminiscent of some of the scenes from Howl's Moving Castle. I also mentioned The Wind Rises, so Spencer will figure that one out.
Well, but even then, one of the, what you were mentioning earlier with like with the scenes where they're running down, like where they're running down the hill together, I got a lot of like My Neighbor Totoro out of that. Mm-hmm. Obviously Ponyo with a lot of the beach scenes, and I'm waiting for him to, it'll click, I swear.
No, it's not, because like The Wind Rises, I think of airplanes. This movie's not
about airplanes. Well, think a little higher than an airplane.
Gosh. Also from Spirited Away, the train.
Yes.
At the end of the film,
the train with, and the way that it, with the water and,
yeah,
and not just the rain but the tunnels and the design of the train and the, some of the shots and the windows and some of the light, and like,
yeah,
you can see the smattering respect of Miyazaki all over this director's, just like his vision for the movie. It's, yeah, he's just combining all the things he loves and going, let me just show you what I love.
Yeah.
Did you get it yet, Spencer?
Was it Cloud?
Yeah!
Which they also utilized a lot of the art scheme behind Toy Story's clouds as well for some of those scenes. The big fluffiness on the, you know, in the sky, the ones on the walls in Andy's, yeah, room. But it's really unique to say that you have a Pixar creator, a Pixar director, who uses Hayao Miyazaki, as a form of inspiration for a Pixar film, when we all know that also there's a partnership with Disney and Miyazaki as distribution, which is because of John Lasseter. Were there any other scenes where you felt, if they were translated into a more anime style, they probably would have came out of straight of a Miyazaki film?
Here's something I actually remember.
Oh, okay.
because I remember, like, there was things that remind me of Miyazaki throughout this film, and I was like, I wonder if they're gonna try to pull off like one of those food shots thing. And that was like the one thing I didn't see them do, and I was like,
well, it's technically hard. Pasta scene.
Well, when he places it before they eat it, they do a little bit, like it's a real, yeah, quick one of those shots, just like when they do the setup for like
it's the very Ponyo, first
when she takes off the lid and you see it and it's got just enough of that tilt to get the shine. And then they go so quick to them eating that it's literally there.
I'm hungry again.
But
all the food in Miyazaki movies look like they're...
It's ridiculous. It's
even like, the weird stuff from Spirited Away that they were eating.
None of that was weird. I would have eaten all of it.
Yeah.
I mean, let's be honest.
Some of them
turn me into
stacks.
A pig. I don't care. Just let me...
Okay, maybe don't want to turn into a pig.
As long as I keep eating that. It's But I do have to agree. Like the scene when it's the very first scene when the dad says, you know, his signature dish, and he puts it down, and it's the plate of pasta and pesto that he makes for them, and it's for a brief second. It's like for like maybe a second, but the scene you can see in full detail. All the strands of the noodles, you can see the sauce that is on it. You can see the torn pieces of basil that are on it. The pesto that's permeated through all the noodles. If you freeze frame that scene, you can see a lot, and it is super reminiscent of Miyazaki. So I actually really like that one, and I didn't even think about it until you mentioned it.
Well, I was probably distracted by the way these two ate that pasta.
Yes. Just hand face. I actually came up with another one that I just realized. So since we have the Porto Rosso Cup, which is involving swimming, eating pasta, and bicycle riding, when we start getting some of the shots of them going through the town on the bike, it's very reminiscent of Kiki's, where I can't remember the kid's name now in the red shirt with the glasses that is racing on the bicycle.
Yes, I know who you're talking about. Yeah. I also don't know.
We're like, you're not Kiki and you're not Gigi. But some of those, the way the bike leans and the movement, I mean, some of that shot can be another one that would go with it too. Like I literally thought of that. And then some of the over the water shots reminded me of Laputa. Where they're up, not like when they're the swimming, but when they get over like the top of the rock and you see them for a second where they're kind of skimming above the water and they're in the air and you see the way the waves are designed because it's like their natural one. It just kind of reminded me of that.
See, Spencer, look, see? I mean, that's the wider shot, but when they do the up close one.
Yeah, but you know Miyazaki, he's like shoving a fictional camera right up into that food.
That's true.
And then we're going, did anybody bring good snacks?
I have to say, I'm actually really excited to see, because not often do you hear of the inspiration being such a juxtaposition from Pixar and from what they've done prior to, because most of the time you get more direct like inspirations from either a certain type of artist that does similar work or movie directing style, things like that, but you never really see Miyazaki as a form of inspiration directly for something coming out of Pixar or Disney, if it's not Miyazaki directly. But in terms of the artistic aspect of the film, another really high point that I really wanted to kind of gush about, we had a little bit of the score playing earlier, but I mean, I have to admit, the score to this movie is like an emotional roller coaster. Everything that is happening in this score will send you up into. I literally was listening to the last song on the soundtrack on the way home from work today, and I kid you not, I almost had to pull over because I was like, oh my gosh, this is making me so much in the feels. Like every emotion that you could think of that correlates with that final scene and what they're doing, it's just, it's beautiful. And I say romantic, not in like, oh, it's a lovey-dovey, like it feels like it's made with like this sense of love in music form that just permeates throughout every note of this soundtrack. And at first I was like, well, I like the movie, and where I work, I hear this movie quite often. But at a point in time I was like, well, you know what, I'm kind of done with Luca. It's like I keep hearing the same thing. And mind you, there's a point in the movie when they start daydreaming about the Vespa that gets really, really loud, and that's the only part that really stuck into my mind for a long time. Yeah. But I started listening to this soundtrack from beginning to end, and I'm like, this soundtrack will send you. Mm-hmm. I don't know. What do you think over there, Miss Texter?
I wasn't like texting people, so thanks. I was doing research because I don't know this composer from anything else.
I was looking up his, like, I've heard none of this. Like, the only thing that I've at least heard of is Wendy from 2020, but like, I didn't see it.
Which I didn't get to see Wendy yet, yeah. Even though it looked that was a good cut. But what else we got in that list, Spencer?
Like, I've never heard of any of these movies is the thing. It's like, you've got Skin, Crystal, Zoe, Freak Show, Shot in the Dark, Brimstone and Glory, Wins It All, The Little Hours. Like, I haven't heard of
him. What's his name?
Dan Romer.
Which apparently he won an Emmy. But literally we're all like...
Beasts of the Southern Wild? I mean, come on, okay. Guys. That and was that one that
Spencer's
was from Netflix.
Spencer's reading it. I haven't seen... I'm
and
looking
I only went
over
back to like 2016.
Oh my gosh. The Good Doctor, that was a good series. That was the one that was on ABC with Freddie Highmore.
Yes.
It's kind of like a Doogie Howser 2.0. Yeah. Let's see, what else?
But so this was...
Atypical, which is that great series on Netflix.
So this, for compositions, this is something that really does their short compositions. We had that conversation mm-hmm. where each track, except for probably the last one, is no more than 2 to 3 minutes at most. And it builds in such a great way that it captures not only the art, but the feel of an Italian summer, the feel of change, of wonder, amazement, and apparently laughter on Eddie's part.
I'm sorry. He was the composer. Is he the composer? He's the composer of The Little Hours. The Little Hours is this movie. It takes place during the Middle Ages where these nuns, they're just so vulgar. They don't even care. And it's a comedy. And it's so off the wall. It's funny, but it's interesting that he's that. Beast of No Nation. That was the movie.
So there you go. Ha-cha-cha.
In Beast of the Southern Wild. It's oddly enough, I've never heard most of his work like directly, but to know that he's like in all these other types of films, I have to go and check him out because I really want to see. I thought you said you had seen Beasts of the Southern Wild, Amy.
No.
I thought you had said you'd seen it.
No.
I've never seen it, so I don't know.
No. I wanted to see Wendy, though. I've been itching to see that one. But what else is new? I have many things to see.
Very true.
We all do.
Yeah. Yes, you all do. but
I'm making friends at the table tonight, I see.
Hey, I made you dinner. Shush. What do you guys think in terms of... Because you guys have listened to several different scores and soundtracks from Pixar films. In terms of the hierarchy of best to worst, where do you think this soundtrack sits? Like, is it closer to... Where do you... Does it sit on the more, like, memorable side? Or is it something more like, you know, who remembers the soundtrack to... I don't know. Airplanes. I don't know. Like, there's not many of them that you...
I didn't even remember Airplane existed until Amy mentioned it earlier today.
I'm sorry. So if we're talking about compositions, most of the time, and I will always butcher his name, so I'm sorry, Michael Giacchino?
Yep.
Yay, I did it right that time. He pretty much kind of locks down most of the compositions for the House of Pixar. And this has a great place among that work. It is not... It's unforgettable in its own way of not only carrying simplicity, but wonder and honesty and evoking such emotion through how it's built. Much like mm-hmm. the story, it's layered in such an elegant, simple, elegant, and intelligent way that it carries it. I mean, I'm not going to say somebody needs to go take the first 7 minutes of Up and find one of the tracks for this and tack it on. But that would be kind of scary if you were able to listen to the last song on this on this soundtrack and then watch the first seven minutes of Up, you're going to be crying all the time.
Because as soon as that crescendo hits, you're like, no, she's on the train to heaven.
I can't even listen to that track.
No. Honestly, like I'm just going through some of Pixar's films right here. Or at least the major actual full feature length films. To be honest, I think the only one that comes close to as... Because if I were to list my top three soundtracks or top three scores from Pixar films, I would have to go with... obviously, Inside Out is one. I love the score from Inside Out. I would have to do... I'm looking at all these. I would have to do... Where'd it go? Finding Nemo. Oh my gosh. Like that.
Which is Tom. So the funny thing is, Thomas Newman, who did Finding Nemo, did WALL-E, and that's on my list. Yeah. And then the other ones are Michael Giacchino.
Well, so, like,
and Dan Romer.
So what did I say? I said Coco.
Inside Out.
Or Inside Out, yes. Finding Nemo. And then obviously Coco for me. Like just the music of it all. But Luca fits into those four for me. Oh my God, even Soul. Like those are my five. Like if I could put those on a loop, I would just... I can't listen to Up. Like I just can't. That one song wrecks you. You can't even hear it without seeing it playing in your mind. Mm-hmm. And it's like no.
And they're all coming from the same. John Batiste is Soul.
John Batiste, yeah.
But then you.
Well, John Batiste and Trent Reznor.
Yeah, and Trent Reznor. Apologies. So
you cannot remove Trent Reznor from that.
I am okay with that. Thank you.
I mean, Nine Inch Nails, then, Trent Reznor.
And then Michael Giacchino basically hit Inside Out, Up, Coco, Ratatouille, Incredibles, mm-hmm. like Incredibles 2. You're talking. He's in such in that space that he's got it down to not even almost to a science. And then you've got Dan Romer's like, hey buddy.
Yeah, Dan Romer comes in is like, yeah, there's room for me at this table, and just comes in here and totally brings it. Which brings me to kind of the focal point of this conversation. I really wanted to get a discussion question with you guys, and I wanted your thoughts. One of the things that we see in the film is, and it's in the trailers as well, we hear Alberto tell Luca, you know, when he has that negative thought in his mind, he says to say, Silencio Bruno, which is what Spencer did at the beginning of this episode.
Yep.
So I want your guys' opinion. We've seen the film. The film's wonderful. The story is really beautiful. But who do you guys think is Bruno?
Perfectly honest, I don't think Alberto realizes Bruno's even a name, really.
Like, really?
I think... because the movie that's really a, goes that's through... That's an interesting thought. Like, showing that he's a parrot. just parrots what he hears with no idea of context or whatever. That's how he gets beaten up by those old ladies who... Yeah, so I think... I think he might not even know. He just heard someone say it. And he's like, I say this now. And it means to... Like, he just assigned his own meaning to things.
No, I really like that. I didn't even think of that. Like, maybe the person who Bruno is nobody at all. Maybe it's somebody he doesn't even know because it was somebody else who said it. I like that thought because I never really kind of considered the fact that he is a parrot. He really does just emulate. Even kind of the final thing that he says before he goes is the same thing he says the first time he meets Luca, and he doesn't even know what it means. And we don't even know what it means at the end of the film either.
And so Luca's like, what does this mean? He's like,
eh. Go find out for me. What about you, Amy? Who do you think Bruno is? Because you, before we even started the episode, you kind of came in, and when I told you that was a question, you're like, oh, yeah, I didn't think it was the easy one that I thought it was. It's actually, you were going to go into full detail. So
yeah.
I'm interested in hearing, who do you think Bruno is?
Well, I think, and this is kind of funny, two-parter, because what Enrico Casarosa, the director, speaks on the Silencio Bruno and who Bruno is. He's got an entire thing on it, too. But I always saw it as when Alberto gives you the answer, it's the voice in your head. It's that insecurity. It's the doubt. It's something that the name almost sounds super preposterous, that it's just some big name. It's like, it's a name that sounds, it should be attached to someone big and overpowering and a little bit larger than life. And then when you apply it to something that it's the part of yourself that is telling you, no, you can't. That...
So it's the literal name of the negative feelings or the negative thoughts in your head is what you're saying.
Yeah, and it's a way to kind of give you that chutzpah that, like, Alberto literally has Luca, who's in this place of not only insecurity, but he's kind of tiptoeing into things as he moves forward and grows, because it's literally the story of part of finding your first best friend, the one that makes you want to do things or inspires you or shows you the movie that you know your parents won't agree with, but you fall in love with the way that it's done or the it's Alberto gives Luca all of that ammunition to quiet the self-doubt in his head. So every time there's something that's scary that he's coming up against, he's remembering that the person that he's with is empowering to keep saying, like, don't shut yourself down. Let's do this. We can do this. Just keep moving forward. And Enrico, I think he even says that it's just something. He's like, I needed to have something to basically...
Well, we're not. This is theorizing. This is just thoughts, obviously.
So I don't think it's attached to anybody in particular. I think it's giving a big name to something. It's giving a big name to big feelings.
When we start this episode over here.
Don't you need the internet?
No.
He googlies a lot. Do you think is the Bruno?
I think so. My thought is because when I first threw this question out there to you guys, I said I didn't want the easy answer, which a lot of people are like theorizing or surmising or assuming that Bruno was probably the name of his father. And that's why, you know, all those negative connotations of like, you know, maybe his father was a big doubter of Alberto's abilities or whatever. And I felt like that was just too easy of an answer.
Well, I think it's also the wrong answer because at a point in the film, you realize that, like, Alberto hides things that remind him of his dad. So it seems super weird that he would be like, my dad's name is Bruno Silencio Bruno.
Yeah.
He's not at that point in his growth where we see him, like, as a character growing through the movie, where he's in that space to quiet that doubt so readily, so loudly, and without care the way that he does.
So I think my thoughts were, I think Bruno... In the same vein as Robert Zemeckis' wonderful movie, Castaway, I think Bruno is like the Wilson for Alberto.
I feel like
Bruno, because just because he stopped counting or whatever doesn't mean that's all the days that he's been on that island.
Yeah.
And we don't know how these people age. We don't know how the sea creatures, I don't want to call them sea monsters because that's just mean, but these sea creatures, we don't know how they age. Maybe they stay young for 100 years and then they turn to older.
Well, like, it was over a year from the scratch marks, like trying to even count when he like stopped counting.
But like I'm saying though, that's just from what he did count. We're not even, you know, incorporating the times that he didn't count. And so maybe during the course of that time, he created maybe this imaginary person or this imaginary friend, or maybe there was, like Wilson, there was this volleyball or there was this something, and that was Bruno. And then over time, Bruno just became a negative mindset that he had to physically push out to keep moving forward and just keep being himself because his dad was no longer there and he wanted a friend. So in my opinion, I feel like Bruno is the imaginary friend that just got too real for Alberto. And so when reality hit him in terms of realizing that, you know what, Bruno is literally just a part of my fractured mindset that's just keeping me somewhat sane, but then at the same time not here on this island, he had to silence Bruno so that way he could keep doing and keep having joy in the ways that he wanted to on the island. That's my thought. I was really kind of thinking about it, and I'm like, I really want to ask this to you guys, because I really feel like this is something that, you know, a Bruno can have different, you know, meanings for different people. And maybe if you're listening, maybe you can ask yourself that. Who is Bruno to you? Or who do you think Bruno is? I'd love to actually hear your answers. If you have the answer to that or your thoughts, drop them on our Facebook page or anywhere on socials. But wrapping this thing up, was there anything else to highlight for you guys? Anything else to kind of notate or anything you guys want to speak on or complain about? Other than Amy didn't like Jim Gaffigan.
I'm indifferent towards Jim Gaffigan, okay?
Jim Gaffigan. Let's just be honest.
He's himself. I'm indifferent. So a couple of things to note where the moments were just so ridiculous. The knocking the children over in search of Luca.
I who knew that Maya Rudolph's character had that much skill with a soccer ball?
Well, it was so just kind of like, not that it was convoluted, but it was hilarious in seeing how it was executed. The Easter eggs of the posters on the walls.
All the posters
was so wonderful. And the... This is going to sound funny. The water. And so the water in this movie, much like Finding Nemo, was a pivotal point for almost everything. We went from wet to dry, essentially, most of the time. But when we start looking at the way that they interact with the water, the bubbles, you can see how Pixar has evolved their water game. It sounds really ridiculous, but how they have evolved their water game, where we get a shot, just it's a very quick shot of the waves breaking on the beach, and it's the stones. And if you've ever been to a lake or to the ocean where most of the beach...
seen Piper.
No, that one was sand, thank you.
There were the little pebbles too on there.
Yes, but it wasn't like this. So you're looking at the way that the bubbles hit. Don't be a jerk. He was in the art department for that. Don't be a jerk. But the way that it hits is so... It's becoming to a point that the water is real, and in almost to the point that it's so real that I'm just like, I can't handle this, guys. I can't handle this.
Was that it?
Santa Mozzarella.
What about you, Spence? Was there anything you wanted to highlight, anything you wanted to complain on, or anything else that really stood out for you?
The only thing I think I want to talk about is I really liked how the credits of this movie continued the story after the movie. Like, it was just like still photos, like, you know, like expressed like through the whole credits. But I still liked how, you know, it showed, like, you know, just what happened after the movie a little bit.
Yeah.
Which I thought was cool.
Kind of the journey of Luca and Alberto as they, you know, explored this new world for themselves in a more healthy way. I actually have one more question for you guys. Do you think this is the end of our little opportunities to see or hear John Ratzenberger in another Pixar film? Because we didn't hear... Yeah, he wasn't in this one. This is the second...
only one there's one more. That's right. You told me.
So he didn't have a role in Soul. You hear his voice, but it's very brief. It's like 3 or 4 words. And he's completely not in this one at all. So do we think he's kind of done with, you know, gracing the Pixar world with his Ratzenberger self?
I don't know. I mean, like, I love that he's a bit of an Easter egg, but...
I was about to say, I looked up his, like, acting credits. There's one in post-production called Monsters at Work.
Oh, that's on
that's
Disney.
That's the series.
That's series for Disney Plus.
Yeah, so he's in that as the Yeti.
Yes.
Oh,
he's,
nice.
He's Mr. Yeti. No.
With the yellow
it's Lemon.
Snow.
No. It's Lemon. I don't really know. I mean, he has been, even 3 or 4 words is kind of like where he pops in and out, and not having him in this, whether it was because of the pandemic, because of his choice, who can say? I would love to say, yes, we need you back, because much like the Underminer, you will always be there.
Spencer, high probability or low probability that John Ratzenberger will come back?
I'm saying high. Even like with something else, I don't get the feeling that this guy is done quite yet, like acting or whatever. Because like just going through his filmography, like he's still like consistently putting out stuff, with the exception of kind of last year. Like he did do some stuff, but like it kind of makes sense.
Is it through Disney and Pixar, or is it just?
Soul is on here, and then also Onward is on here, and then like there's some TV shows that he was in. So like it still seems like he's doing like his thing, so I kind of think we'll still see him around for a couple more years.
Alright, well, wrapping this whole thing up, let's go ahead and go around the table. We'll rate, we'll see how the film does. Is the film pass or fail? And obviously, how many monocles out of 5 does it get? In Amy's case, it's usually the shape or wear or tear on the monocle that usually also signifies the rating. Because you've done like
cracked
monocles or whatever monocles or whatever. So
only I'm giving
room for your uniqueness in the show. So let's go ahead and start with you, Amy. How many does this film pass or fail? And how many monocles?
So, of course, this film passes for me. If you haven't heard me expounding upon water in half of this episode, you might need to rewind it just to go, oh, she said it more than once.
She did.
Water. This is such a delight to watch. As I stated previously, I have I have a lot of intentions to continue to rewatch this movie regardless of how old I get. Whether it's the wonderful writing, the amazing character growth, or the soundtrack, I will keep eating my pasta and watching the Luca. So out of Monocles, this will get a 5 out of 5 for me. Mm. And no, they are not cracked. They are glistening in the Italian sun.
Oh my gosh. Spencer!
Yeah, this movie passes for me. This was a real fun movie to watch. I don't know what it is about this movie, but it kind of just even like reminds me of like some of my favorite childhood movies, like The Goonies, in the sense of like discovery type stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So like it gives me real strong vibes on that kind of thing, and I just really love this movie. So it's also going to be 5 out of 5 monocles for me too.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Okay. Well, in terms of myself, the film, this is a wonderful chapter in the efforts of Pixar to continue to create and cultivate wonderful imagination and allowing people, not just children, but people to live in their world, even if it's for an hour and 45 minutes, 2 hours, to be able to be a part of that. And I have to applaud every member of Pixar who had a hand in this and supported this. In that, you know what? Hey, we see you. We know your efforts. We respect it. We honor it. And we stand by you. I mean, this movie is a masterpiece in an effort of showing just a simple film where two people who are best friends learn what the world has for them. So, in terms of pass or fail, this film obviously passes for me. And in terms of monocles, I have no other choice but to give it 5 beautiful, intact, wonderfully made monocles, because this movie is by far one of my favorite films of the Pixar universe. And I actually, side note, I can't wait to see how this film will fit into the Pixar theory.
Oh, yeah. That's a great question about that. Also, see if you can find the Pizza Planet mobile in this.
Yeah. Did you not find it?
Yeah, I did.
It's in the third act.
Isa Vespa.
Yeah. Did you find the Luxa Ball?
No, I didn't find that one.
It's also in the third act.
See?
You're going to have to rewatch.
Repeat viewings.
But that about wraps up another awesome episode of The Filmlosophers. Remember, you can check us out on our website at filmlosophers.com. There we got over 270 episodes on just about everything you could ever want to hear pertaining to film. I was like, we don't have anything about cars. We don't have anything about health. We're just movies. And yeah, that's not bad.
We know what we're good at.
We love to talk. Check us out there. Also, check us out on any streaming platform. Audio Boom, Google Play, Libsyn, Player FM, iTunes, Pandora, Spotify, all over where you can find podcasts. You'll find us there. We'd love to hear from you and drop us a line. Let us know what you think of the show. Also, check us out on our social pages at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on our Twitter and Instagram page at filmlosophy101. Let us know what you think. What are your thoughts on the Bruno situation? I'd love to hear what your guys' interpretation of that is. Who knows? Maybe somebody may come up with a really incredible answer that even blows all 3 of ours away. So, who knows? I'd love to hear. Either way, this was a great conversation. I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation as much as I enjoyed the movie. And you know what? I probably will be rewatching it again tonight. So, but like I said, that about wraps up another awesome episode from The Filmlosophers. So, from all of us here, I'm Eddie.
I'm Spence.
Apparently, I'm intern Amy now.
Ooh.
Part-timer. Class dismissed.